If you would, go ahead and turn your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 20 will be our text today as we continue from the series we started back in January. And I wanted to let you know that this will actually be our last text from 1 Samuel for this calendar year, which I have mixed feelings about, which is funny because I made that decision. But the reason for that is, the reason for mixed feelings is I've been really enjoying it. I hate to break and I look forward to getting back into it. But it's a good stopping point because the first seven or so chapters were kind of the calling and rise of Samuel. And then the next seven or so chapters were Israel wanting a king, if you remember. And then Saul being called by God to be king. And then Saul ultimately rejecting God and then God rejecting him. The last four chapters or so after that has been David being anointed and kind of coming onto the scene. And spoiler alert, after this chapter, David will spend the rest of the book on the run as a fugitive, as it were, from a murderous Saul. And there was no way we were going to be able to cover all of that before we got into Thanksgiving and Advent and Christmas. So we decided that I'm going to push that off. We're going to get back into chapter 21 of 1 Samuel early on in January. And for the rest of this calendar year, we're going to spend time in the New Testament, which will be a novel idea for us, I guess, this year. Because we've only actually been in the New Testament four Sundays this entire year. And that's okay because Christ invites us to read the Old Testament in light of himself anyway. And that's what we've been doing. And that's what we're going to continue to do today. This is also a sweet chapter, I think, to kind of take a break on, as we're going to look once again at the relationship between David and Jonathan. And it's such a sweet friendship, such a sweet relationship that they have. 2 weeks ago, we looked more at the friendship and the love that they had as the focus in chapter 18. This week, we're going to look at the covenant that they have between the two of them. And we are going to look at the covenant in three main sections. We're going to look at the covenant being one of steadfast love. We're going to look at the covenant being one of self-sacrifice. And we're going to look at the covenant being one of everlasting peace. And as you might imagine, even just from those markers or titles, we are going to, at Jesus' invitation, see how much of this chapter, again, points to the covenant that Christ has made with him and his church. And we're going to celebrate that this morning, and then we'll celebrate that through the taking of the Lord's Supper as we conclude our service. I'll tell you in the very beginning, I actually see, we talk about how we see types of Christ or the aroma of Christ kind of in the text. And this week, for the most part, I actually see Jonathan as being that person whom will point forward to Jesus in a number of ways, which I'll explain in a moment when we get there. So if you're a note taker, you can write this down for our first point, is a covenant of steadfast love. And to give you a sense, I'm going to spend a lot of time in the first section, less time in the second, and hardly any in the third, because I know when I'm in churches and the pastor says we got 3 points, and then the first point is 30 minutes, y'all get a little fidgety. So I'm just telling you right in the front end, like it's going to be a long first point, but it's going to, okay, we're covering a lot of text. So let's get started as we encourage our hearts with the covenant that we have through Christ our Lord. Verse 1, David has been attempted, Saul has attempted to murder David in a number of ways. And David has dodged those attempts with the help of God's providence through a number of people. He was just in Ramah with Samuel, or Saul tried to get to him there, and David again evaded him because the Spirit of God incapacitated Saul, as it were. So we pick up the story. Then David fled from Naoth and Ramah and came and said before Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my guilt, and what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?" And Jonathan said to him, "Far from it, you shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing either great or small without disclosing it to me. And why should my father hide this from me? It is not so." But David vowed again, saying, "Your father knows well that I have found favor in your eyes." And he thinks, "Do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death." Let's stop there. So after fleeing from Saul, David comes and finds Jonathan. We don't know where exactly this is, but he basically comes to Jonathan and he says, "Listen, why is your dad trying to kill me? It's obvious he is, but what have I done to incite this murderous rage from your father?" Jonathan, who's used to having Saul tell everything to him, basically says to David, "My dad's not trying to kill you." And we might say, "Jonathan, why are you being so obtuse?" Of course he is. But the last conversation that Jonathan had, if you remember, at the beginning of chapter 19, Saul assured Jonathan that David would not die. And there's no reason to think that Jonathan had any idea of all of the conniving and planning that Saul has had from that point to try to have David killed. So David's here convincing Jonathan, no, listen, your dad does want to kill me. He took you out of the loop on this one because he knows that you have kindness towards me. Believe me, he wants me to die, and I want to know why that is. Verse 4, Jonathan said to David, okay, whatever you say, I will do for you. David said to Jonathan, behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit at the table with the king. But let me go that I may hide myself in the field till the third day at evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the clan. If he says, good, well, then it'll be well with your servant. But if he is angry, then know that harm is determined by him. Therefore, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. But if there is guilt in me, kill me yourself, for why should you bring me to the father, to your father? And Jonathan said, far be it from you. If I knew that it was determined by my father that harm should come to you, would I not tell you? Then David said to Jonathan, well, who will tell me if your father answers you roughly? And Jonathan said to David, come, let us go out into the field. So they both went out into the field. Okay, so here's a test of sorts that David is bringing out to prove his own understanding of Saul's intentions and to prove them to Jonathan. He's basically saying, hey, here's the monthly festival as prescribed by the Mosaic law that we have to attend. David, at this point, is one of the officials. It's him, it's Jonathan, it's Abner, the general, it's of course Saul. And they would be expected, as it were, to cultural propriety, to come into at this festival and share the meal and be together. So even though Saul has been trying to kill David, there's still an expectation that David would be a part of the bigwigs, as it were, the people who matter, as it were, at this feast. David's saying, I'm not going to go. And if Saul is cool with that, then maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he's not actually trying to kill me and we're okay. But if Saul is angry about that, then you can know he planned on killing me even when I came back for the new moon feast. And then Jonathan said, okay, fine, we'll do this plan. And then David said, okay, but if you find out that he does want to kill me, how are you going to let me know that? Because we already know that Saul has henchmen casing houses and doing all these things. They're a little inept. We'll see that again today. But how would you let me know? How would you warn me without you leading Saul's people right to where I am so that they might kill me? And so now it's Jonathan's turn to devise a plan, and he will do so in verse 23. By the way, I almost entitled this sermon As the Spear Turns, because it's kind of, it's just so like, right? There's a lot of complications here, but Jonathan said to David, the Lord, the God of Israel, be witness. When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day, behold, if he is well disposed toward you, then shall I not then send and disclose it to you? But should it please my father to do you harm, the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also, if I do not disclose it to you and send you away that you might go in safety. May the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. If I am still alive, show me the steadfast love of the Lord that I may not die. And do not cut off your steadfast love from my house forever when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. And Jonathan made, or we might say renewed, or furthered, a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord take vengeance on David's enemies. And Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. Then Jonathan said to him, tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed because your seat will be empty. On the third day, go down quickly to the place where you hid yourself when the matter was in hand, and remain beside the stone heap. And I will shoot three arrows to the side of it, as though I shot at a mark. And behold, I will send the boy, saying, go find the arrows. If I say to the boy, look, the arrows are on this side of you, take them, then you are to come. For as the Lord lives, it is safe for you, and there is no danger. But if I say to the youth, look, the arrows are beyond you, then go, for the Lord has sent you away. And as for the matter of which you and I have spoken, behold, the Lord is between you and me forever. Okay, so here's the plan. David is going to not come to the feast that he would be expected to be at, as we talked about. And Jonathan will go out into the field to let David know the results of his kind of ferreting out, sounding out his father's intentions. He's going to bring a young lad with him. I kind of, my heart warms towards this little guy in this story numerous times, because how cool would it be to be the little guy that gets to fetch the arrows for the prince, right? That's just kind of a neat opportunity to do that. It's like if you're a Wimbledon ball boy, but like times a billion. It's just a really cool thing. And he's like, if I fire the arrows and say, hey, young man, the arrows are close, then David would take that as his cue that he could come back. If he says the arrows are far, they're beyond you, then David should take that as his cue that he needs to be far. He needs to go away because his life is in danger. This is the plan that they've devised, and we'll see how this unfolds. But I want to take a moment and pause and comb back through this text again to look at the covenant that they have made. And I want to observe three things about the covenant that they speak to one another. Look back at verse 8 with me. And if you don't have the scriptures in front of you, you'll be on the screen. David appeals to Jonathan. He says, deal kindly with your servant. That word kindly there is the same word translated elsewhere as steadfast love. It's the same word that we read in the refrain from Psalm over and over again this morning. He says, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. David is appealing to the Son of the King, and that'll be the language that I use a lot today to point to how Jesus is the Son of the Heavenly King. He appeals to him. He's scared. Like, let's put ourselves in David's sandals for a second. He is very scared. He's now very clear that the most powerful man he knows is trying to kill him. And he also knows that his son Jonathan would have incentive for David to die, because Jonathan is heir to the throne. And if David dies, that's only going to clear the way, because David is clearly, for many people, seen as a great threat to Saul's monarchy, which would ultimately be bequeathed to Jonathan. So David is scared, and he's always kind of thinking, how do I know that you're not going to flip, change your mind, side with Dad, and bring me into a trap? How can I trust you? And so he appeals to the covenant that Jonathan of his own volition had made back in chapter 18. He says, whatever happens, please remember your covenant, the one that you initiated, and deal kindly with me. He appeals to that for safety. And that was the first aroma of Christ that I kind of got a whiff of in reading this text. Because you and I, if we're believers, we are in a covenant with Jesus, not a contract. Not something where we can opt out, or he's going to opt out if he thinks he could find a better deal, or if he thinks our sin has gotten too great or anything like that. We are in a covenant with the Lord, a covenant that he initiated, not us. Throughout the entire Bible, throughout the New Testament, we see sinners running away from God and Jesus coming after us, God the Father drawing us, Jesus inviting us into a covenant that is made and inaugurated in his own blood, as we will celebrate later today. And so we, like David here, in a sense, could even have security and comfort in appealing to God, even in our prayers for protection or whatever it may be, and say, God, thank you for your covenant. Please be kind to me in accordance with the covenant that you have made, Jesus, the Son of the King Most High. It's a covenant, secondly, that we can see is born again out of love. We already saw that word. It's hesed in Hebrew that was mentioned back in verse 8. Now look down at verse 14. It's Jonathan's turn to talk. If I am still alive, why would Jonathan say that? Jonathan knows that this could, if the kingdom stayed separated, that if David comes to power and Jonathan is still alive, now Jonathan is appealing to their covenant that he would be protected. I'll explain more of that in a moment. But Jonathan says, if I'm still alive, assuming when you come to power, David, show me the steadfast love of the Lord that I may not die. Do not cut off your steadfast love from my house forever when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. And Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord take vengeance on David's enemies. And Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. That word is really hard to carry over into English. It's just, that's why sometimes it's kindness, sometimes it's love. It carries with it an unconditional sense to it and an unchanging permanent sense to it, which is why it's often translated in the ESV, steadfast love. It's a love that is enduring. It's unflinching. It's a devotional love that holds up over the pressures of time, pressures of life, and in great distance. It's covenantal. It's others-focused. It's not the kind of love that you fall into and fall out of. It's that same kind of love that we read about that describes God, who is referred to elsewhere in the Bible as being love. God is love, and that part of his essence of who he is pours out into how he deals with sinners like you and I. The covenant that Jonathan and David have here are mimicking, in a sense, a lesser sense for sure, but the covenant that God has with his people. And then thirdly, I want to point out here that this is a covenant of radical love. It's a covenant of radical love. It's hard. Well, maybe it's not so hard. Do you know what kings did all throughout history in every single country in the world when other people were committing treason against them? Killed them. All the time. This is actually fairly recent. I looked this up briefly. I Googled treason and laws, and still on the books in many nations all around the world, if you put yourself up against the king as if you were to try to take his place or to become an enemy of the state, depending on the severity, capital punishment is the crime. I was mentioning, I read the book of the missionary to Burma, Adoniram Judson, and he talked about in his time there, every time a new king came to power, they just killed all the opposing kings and their families. And it was true. You would read this in history, you would see this in France, you would see this in South America, you would see this. That's just what you did. And it was common to all. And so what you would expect from a worldly lens for Jonathan to want to do is to kill David because he's a threat to his kingdom. And what they would expect David to do if he takes the throne is to kill Jonathan because he could be a threat. That's what everybody would say. And everybody in the entire world, as heinous as it might seem to us, would say, duh. That's what kings and princes do. You get power and you consolidate that power by wiping out every one of your enemies. David and Jonathan are doing something totally radical in this covenant. They are saying, if you come to power, protect me. And for my sake, as I am the prince right now, I will protect you. Because I love you, we're going to have a relationship that is wholly different. It's radical. And when I think about just radical things and love that kind of, you say, why would you do that? Why? I just don't, it doesn't make sense. My mind again is brought to Jesus. Because so much of what Jesus does for us ought to leave us just kind of shaking our heads saying, I don't quite understand it, but I'm thankful for it. Let me read Romans 5 as a demonstration of this. Verse 6, the scriptures say, and receive this because this is for all of us, while we were still weak, at the right time Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one might dare even to die. But God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And if we meditate on that and really think about what that means, there's nothing about that that would make you and I say, that makes total sense. That the God of the universe would send his son to die for people like you and I, who, if it wasn't for the grace of God, are very comfortable persisting in cosmic treason. We fairly regularly, and we'll see this in a moment, shake our fist at God and say, no, King, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. We're born into that disposition. And so we see that a just God would be capital punishment. That's all over the Bible. And yet God sent his son not because you and I started to clean our lives up, not because you and I started to do some religious things, not because he thought we were worthy to be saved. He sent his son that while we were still sinners, because of his love for us, he died for us. And if we really think about that deeply, we ought to say to ourselves, I don't know that I understand that. And that's okay. Because his thoughts are higher than our thoughts, and his ways are higher than our ways, and we can simply marvel at the grace that Christ has given us in the radical love of this covenant that he's made with us. Let me remind us again of this aspect of the gospel. Look at verse 8. It really jumped out to me. David says something that I thought pointed to our state. David says to Jonathan, if there is guilt in me, kill me yourself, for why should you bring me to your father? What David is saying is, if I am guilty of treason against the king, do the right thing. Kill me yourself. He's admitting that this sin at that level would be worthy of death. That's what he is saying there, and everybody would have known that. And David, and you'll see this throughout the rest of the chapter, goes out of his way to never, ever even be remotely accused of raising his hand against Saul. Even when he has multiple opportunities coming up to take Saul's life, he refrains from doing so. You would never be able to say that at any moment David tries to take the throne away from Saul. But he does say, if there's guilt in me, if I've sinned against the king, then the son of the king should not bring me into his presence. And it's weird in a sense because I see here an anti, it's like the photo negative copy of the gospel. Because the gospel says that a holy God, through an innocent son, brings sinners into his presence. This is an innocent son, or an innocent person, right, through an innocent son being brought to the presence of a sinful king. So it's a little bit reversed. But when I think about the flip again, what it truly says, we have to, for the gospel to be sweet, we have to understand that we cannot go before a king if there's guilt on our charge, on our account. We cannot get there. David knows that, and we should know that. And so the son, Jesus, who is oftentimes pictured on wall hangings, holding a sheep really daintily or whatnot, and he is so loving. Let me read this sobering passage about the end of days in Revelation chapter 6. Verse 15, it says, "The kings of the earth and the great ones and the generals and the rich and the powerful and everyone, slave and free, no matter what station of life they were in, they hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains, calling to the mountains and rocks, saying, 'Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who is seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand?'" I think we live in a culture who thinks that Jesus is just everybody's buddy, and that actually I think we live in a culture where we assume that we're good, and if the king of the universe didn't want us, there's something wrong with him. Our default is an anti-gospel. This is saying here that if there is sin found in us, when we see Jesus, well, we'd rather have rocks fall on us. It's sobering, but I bring it out to mention this. We should remember that when we think about the gospel and celebrate the grace that we've received. Because for those who have put their trust in Jesus Christ, we have no guilt. We have no sin. The Son can and will bring us before the Father, the King of the universe, sinless, guiltless, because of what he did on our behalf. Ephesians 2, cross point, remember this. Remember that you were at that time separated from Christ, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now in Christ Jesus, you who were once far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. And so when we take the Lord's Supper in a moment, we gather this morning celebrating that we have assurance that the Son of the King will bring us into his presence guiltless. And I don't know what's going to happen the rest of this week. I don't know what happened this past week, but you will not find any better news than that. That is our hope. That's all we've got. That's what gathers us here this morning. The second thing we see in the covenant is a covenant of self-sacrifice. So David hid himself in the field, and when the new moon came, the king sat down to eat food. The king sat on his seat as at other times, on the seat by the wall. Jonathan sat opposite, and Abner sat by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. Yet Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, "Something has happened to him. He is not clean. Surely he is not clean." But on the second day, the day after the new moon, David's place was empty. And Saul said to Jonathan, his son, "Why has not the son of Jesse come to the meal, either yesterday or today?" Jonathan answered Saul, "Well, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. He said, 'Let me go, for our clan holds a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. So now, if I have found favor in your eyes, let me get away and see my brothers.' For this reason, he has not come to the king's table." So the stage is set. This is the plan. And now we're going to see how Saul reacts. Remember, if Saul reacts and says, "Oh, that's great, I'm glad he gets to spend time with his family," then we can think that Saul has a positive disposition towards David. But if he reacts angrily, then this is how they would know that harm was meant to befall him. Verse 30. "Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. And he said to him, 'You son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die.' Then Jonathan answered Saul, his father," same question he asked him back in the beginning of chapter 18, "Why should he be put to death? What has he done?" This is going to be predictable. Are you ready? Verse 33. "But Saul hurled his spear at him." Good grief. This is what all this guy, this is his only move. He just throws spears, and he always misses. "He hurled his spear at him to strike him." He's got to go to a spear throwing class or something. This is just unbelievable. So Jonathan knew that his father was determined to put David to death. Yeah, I guess. "And Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had disgraced him." So you see, it starts with Saul getting mad, and then he blames Jonathan's mother in a much more egregious terms than happens today. You know, sometimes couples, if a kid's bad at school, you know, parents will go together, "Let me tell you what your son did today," right? Kind of push it away. "Your son in this moment," it's a way of saying, "They didn't get that from me, they got from that you, from you." So he's saying, "You son of a wicked and rebellious," or "perverse and rebellious woman." That could actually be translated, "You son of perversion and rebellion," which is probably more appropriate because we have no indication here that, you know, Jonathan's mom did anything to deserve such a tongue lashing here from Saul. But in any fact, anyway, Saul goes on and he says, "You know, John, you're embarrassing your family. You're embarrassing your mother, the one that brought you into this world. How could she bring about such a fool as you? You should be ashamed of yourself for choosing David over your own future. You've brought shame into our family in doing so. So, John, bring David here so you can die, or else you don't have a kingdom awaiting you. Don't you understand?" And Jonathan says, "Why would we kill this guy? He hasn't done anything wrong at all." And then the spear is thrown, and Saul's angry. He's standing. Jonathan is angry because he said these bad things about David. He leaves the room kind of in a huff. He's furious. Saul walks off. He's picking up his spear. And I just picture Abner eating there, sitting there, just eating his soup. Like, man, what a dysfunctional family. This is crazy. And we can relate to that sometimes indeed. But immediately here we see a foreshadowing of Christ, because in Luke chapter 12, verse 53, Jesus promises that although he is the Prince of Peace, even in our own families, there will be some who come to believe in Jesus, the Messiah, in the line of David, and some who don't. And Luke 12, 53, for example, says they will be divided, father against son and son against father. And so here we see a foreshadowing, again, David, a type of Christ, where there is a divide in this kingdom between father and son, because one is giving their allegiance to God's chosen one in David, and the other is focused only on himself. And father is irritated that the son is not obsessed with his own kingdom. Look again at verse 31. He says, "As long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established." And this is the obsession that we're born into. We are fundamentally lovers of ourselves and our kingdoms, and we want our kids, I guess, to build their kingdom as well. And so that's what Saul is saying to Jonathan. You can't give away your life, as it were, to this guy. Your kingdom won't be established. And that still happens today. Think about the unbelieving parent with believing children. Maybe that's you. Maybe you've experienced this. The child with an eye on the kingdom and a heart for God will do many bizarre things in the eyes of their parents. They'll give financially to their churches. They might not join a sports league that has the kids playing on Sunday mornings. They might pursue holiness with a zeal that just seems bizarre to mom and dad. They might change careers from a higher paying job to a lesser paying job to be in ministry, whatever it may be. And the parents will think them fools. Why would you do that? Don't mess with your retirement nest egg. I think you're taking this Christianity thing a little bit too seriously. Things like that. Maybe you've experienced that. And if you have, you're in good company. Because you're not the first person in the world who's loved Jesus to the point where a parent has accused you of being a fool for doing so. And yet we know that we're not fools by any stretch when we put the kingdom of God first. The second could be a believing parent. This is kind of the idea that Saul has good intentions. It's the believing parent who still has a bent towards worldly measures of financial security. There is no shortage of believing, well-meaning parents in the biographies of many well-known missionaries that you and I know, that when their children were getting ready to go to that distant land or that hard mission field, the parents basically said, are you sure you want to do that? I mean, they don't have any medical care there whatsoever, and there are lost people that need Jesus here too. Why would you go all the way over there? I know personally a story of a young man who may end up in ministry. I don't know. I mean, in vocational pastoral ministry, he feels called that way. He's, I think, gifted that way. And his parents, I believe, are believers, but they don't support him because they think the money's not good enough, candidly. And last time, they came from a pretty wealthy family, and they were on vacation to Europe. And they were having a conversation about what the young man was going to do with the rest of his life. And dad put his arm around Sonny and said, son, I just want you to be able to take trips like this with your kids. I'm just looking out for the best for you. This is why I want you to, you know, stay with this career path. And maybe, you know, you can still serve in the church. You don't have to give yourself to being a pastor. And I know that family. And I know that sounds like wisdom in a sense. Maybe to you, it strikes you as foolishness. But to get the heart of the father in that scenario is just to help the son protect their stewardship in the way that he thinks he must do in worldly wisdom. But he's kind of getting in the way of what the son is doing because he's basically still saying, you can't just abandon yourself to the kingdom of God. Wherever he calls you, whatever he calls you to do, that's foolishness. Hedge it a little bit here, man. Serve sometimes, do some things, but still make good money. Still make sure that you know, I don't have to belabor the point. We need to be the kinds of people that I think adopt Jonathan's perspective here and basically says, I don't need to build my own kingdom because God promises he'll take care of me. Seek first the kingdom of God and everything else will be given to me. I don't need to worry about it. And that's where true joy is to be found. And moreover, this is where I bring in one of the most famous missionary quotes of all time from Jim Elliot, who was martyred at 28 by giving the gospel. But he said, he is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain that which he cannot lose. Because I've yet to go to see a funeral procession that has a U-Haul pulling all the stuff behind the person so that all their riches and toys and games and fun will be with them in the afterlife. That's not how it works. And Jim Elliot knew that. So many of these missionary guys are like killing it in school. They're prestigious in sports. They're doing all these things in the world around them saying, you would leave all of that and go to Central America, South America, Burma, India? What are you thinking? And Jim's saying, what am I thinking? I know that my God is a king of heaven. Like, that's where I'm going to be forever. That's wisdom. I'll leave all that to him. It's that worldly wisdom versus godly wisdom. We need to have the mind of Christ. Philippians 2, we're encouraged to have this mind among ourselves, which is ours in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form. He humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. I'll tell you this, I don't know what God might call you or I to leave. Some kind of security, some kind of career, some kind of whatever it may be. It's nothing compared to the second person of the Trinity taking on flesh and entering into the sufferings of this world because he loves us. I can't fathom it. It's one of those things, it's the second thing that I'm just shaking my head like, man, that's how much you love us. And for your own glory, empty yourself. And it goes back to love. It's all about love. Saul loves himself. He might have some love for God. maybe some love for Jonathan, maybe some love for the kingdom, but ultimately he just loves himself and he can't think about loving anyone or anyone else more than that. And so when his son would actually love someone else to that great of a degree, his father thinks he's an idiot. But may God help us to, with by his grace, be not lovers of self, but to love the Lord and to love others above ourselves as Christ did for us in Philippians 2. Finally, we see a covenant of everlasting peace. Let's read verse 35 to the end. In the morning, Jonathan went out into the field to the appointment with David and with him a little boy. And he said to his boy, "Run and find the arrows that I shoot." As the boy ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. And when the boy came to the place of the arrow that Jonathan had shot, Jonathan called after the boy and said, "Is not the arrow beyond you?" And Jonathan called after the boy, "Hurry, be quick, do not stay." So Jonathan's boy gathered up the arrows and came to his master, but the boy knew nothing. Only Jonathan and David knew the matter. And Jonathan gave his weapons to his boy and said to him, "Go and carry them over to the city." And as soon as the boy had gone, David rose from beside the stone heap and fell on his face to the ground and bowed 3 times. And they kissed one another and wept with one another, David weeping the most. And Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, because we have sworn, both of us, in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord shall be between me and you and between my offspring and your offspring forever.'" And he rose and departed and went into the city. It seems like this is another case of incompetent goons from Saul. Because they were probably casing Jonathan, and they're out there, you know, with their shades on, and they're probably smoking their cigarettes, having their drinks, playing poker, you know, watching Jonathan's house, and they see the front door open, they say, hey, I was about to say some kind of, like, gangster name, and I immediately thought I'd be just really foolish, so I'm just going to say, not a gangster name. "Hey, guy, they're leaving the house. Look, what's Jonathan doing?" And they say, "Oh, no, he's just got that lad with him. He's just going out for target practice. Not a big deal. Listen, it's your turn in the card game." And so they let Jonathan go, and so they're saying, "Yeah, he'll be back soon. It's archery practice." Jonathan, they do the plan. The boy goes and gets the arrows. He has no clue what's going on. I bring the arrows back. We're all good. And after the boy runs into the city, Jonathan basically looks around and says, "You know what? I think the coast is clear enough. I want to run out one last time," because for them, this may very well be the last time they see each other. I mean, these guys loved each other deeply, and they're aware that this might be the very last time they see each other in this world. And so they say, essentially, "You know what? It's worth the risk for one more goodbye." And we don't need to waste time addressing the importing of a homosexual lens on this culture 3,000 years ago. Their kissing would not have been at all uncommon among heterosexual men. 4 New Testament letters end with the instruction to greet one another with a holy kiss. You can go around parts of the world even today where heterosexual friends will hold hands while they're walking through the marketplace. They'll kiss when they greet one another. It's not sexual at all. There's no reason to make it that way. It's absolutely importing a very recent ethic onto a culture 3,000 years ago. It's simply two men who do love each other deeply and are weeping because they might not ever see each other again. And in their last words to each other, verse 42, Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, because we have sworn, both of us, in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord shall be between me and you and between my offspring and your offspring forever.'" And if you can picture it, Jonathan goes into the city and David goes away into who knows where. He's now on the run in perpetuity. I just want to point out that the covenant between them is one between their offspring forever, and we will see that fulfilled in 2 Samuel, where David will show kindness to the household of Jonathan. But it even reflects the covenant that we have with the Lord. It's one that is not going to be canceled. It's one that we have forever. And I think about just so much of this chapter relates to where we are even this morning. We have a covenant with the Lord that was inaugurated by him, born out of his unending steadfast love for us, with a guarantee of eternal peace awaiting us. And Jonathan and David would have left one another longing for each other, and we gather here this morning longing for Jesus. There is a part of you and of me that is just dissatisfied with this world. It is going to stay that way because that part of us is that part that longs for Christ. And we can't wait to be with him, and we can't wait to see him. And by the covenant that he has inaugurated by his blood, we can be sure that we will soon and very soon. And that's our hope this morning.